brought to you by Burr and Foreman, broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia. It's time for Results Matter Radio, where we bring you pertinent business information and offer real-life solutions to help drive desired results for you, whatever your business may be. Now, here are your hosts, Elizabeth Gordon and Lee Cantor.
Welcome to Results Matter. Thanks for tuning in. Today's discussion is one you definitely are going to be glad that you caught. We are talking about the inevitable today: death, taxes, and changes. These are things that may be uncomfortable topics for some people, but they are inevitable, and they're very important to know all the information that you possibly can on. And we've got a great panel with us to share a lot of information with us about what's being called the upcoming fiscal cliff here in the United States. By now, most taxpayers are well aware of the unprecedented tax increases, which are scheduled to occur on January 1st, 2013. Those changes include increases in personal income taxes, Social Security taxes, and estate and gift taxes. This is a very complex issue, and that's why I've brought a panel of experts here to give you all the right information. So Susan Tillery is with us, Paraclete Financial, Inc. Susan, you're the president and co-founder of Paraclete Financial, and you have over 30 years of experience in tax, philanthropy, and financial planning. So this is something that you know a lot about. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Elizabeth, and I'm very, very pleased to be here today. Just wanted to start out by sharing really what the fiscal cliff is all about, and it's really just a series of spending cuts and tax increases that are going to go into effect at the end of the year unless Congress acts to change this. It's predicted to create about a 4% hit to our GDP. And since we've only been growing about 1.5 to 2% a year the last few years, economists and experts feel like this could really send us into a recession. Now, the tax increases are going to affect estate taxes, income taxes, as well as payroll taxes, as you just mentioned, Elizabeth. And so all the people listening just really need to talk to their most trusted advisor. That is really what I would suggest doing. What we are doing with our clients, and at our firm, we don't manage any assets. We don't sell any products. We don't act as CPAs. I am a CPA, but we don't act in that manner other than doing some tax consulting. And we don't practice law, but we do estate planning consulting. And we look at it from a holistic perspective. And what we are sharing with our clients is to take the time to sit down with us and look at the overall picture. And we are really recommending that they stay steady for the course for the most part. There are certain people that would benefit from making some changes, possibly due to the increase that is potential out there for the capital gains. But we are really, when we sit down and take on a new client, we really advise them to have an asset allocation and to stay steady with that, with their investments. Don't run with the herd. Keep your hand on the wheel. There are some changes coming, and every situation is unique. So we would look at each client's situation, their investment allocations, and every year we have them rebalance. We keep them disciplined so that they rebalance once a year. And as we are rebalancing, which we usually do in the October-November timeframe, we will be looking to see if some gain harvesting needs to be done. And I'm sure it will need to be done with some, but it doesn't mean that it needs to be done with all. And that's really important, is that every individual situation is unique. And if someone hears some advice being given, they need to know that they should go seek that advice for themselves and not act on something that they've heard.
And that's a good disclaimer, and I want to ask you more about this, and obviously we want to let listeners know that none of this should be taken as tax or legal advice. All situations are unique. And I want to bring Jason into the conversation now. Jason Meadows is the head of Frazier & Dieter's tax department and a partner of Frazier & Dieter. Jason, welcome to the show. Give us your perspective and some of the things that you've been working on with clients with regards to the changes that are taking place or maybe taking place in 2013?
Sure. Well, starting in 2013, in the absence of any legislative action, there's a lot of uncertainty that's going to come into the equation. And so what our clients right now are really trying to do is take advantage of the current certainty that exists up through 12/31/2012. And those actions really depend on who the client is. Any client that was thinking about expanding, we've seen them sort of table those expansion plans until they can get a better feel for what's going to happen. We see a lot of clients looking to take money off the table while the capital gains rates are still at 15% and while you still have the existence of qualified dividends at 15% versus ordinary income rates. I do a lot of work particularly in the private equity arena. And what we see in the private equity arena is a rush to conclude deals by the end of the year. And a lot of that is really being driven by the seller, again, who wants to benefit from the known lower tax rates that are currently in existence. And some of these funds that aren't committed funds are looking to put, and even committed funds really, are looking to put loans in place, notes in place for the acquisition of businesses. And what that's going to allow them to do is get a little bit more breathing room and buy them a little bit of time until some certainty, good or bad, enters into the equation for 2013. And if the certainty is bad and tax rates are allowed to go up, they'll just accelerate the tax event in 2012. And if the certainty turns out to be favorable and there's an extension of the current favorable rates, then they'll be able to stretch out the tax impact that they would have recognized in 2012 into subsequent years and benefit from those lower rates.
Now, the impact is different depending on income levels, but there is impact to everyone at every income level. Give us the detail around that.
Around the fiscal cliff?
Right.
Well, if the fiscal cliff is allowed to expire, to further the earlier point, it's going to create really tax increases across the board. I think one statistic that I read that was in some of the opening notes is that the average family's tax liability is going to go up by about $3,500, and the middle income tax liability is going to increase by about $2,000. Because the fiscal cliff, sort of like the Bush tax cuts, have become part of the American lexicon, but a lot of people don't know the exact specifics behind it. But what the fiscal cliff refers to, again, is the expiration of those 2001 and 2003 tax cuts that should have expired at the end of 2010, but that were extended by an additional 2 years by the 2010 Taxpayer Relief Act. It also represents an end to the temporary reduction, 2% reduction in payroll taxes, and that allows people to put money in their paychecks on a per pay period basis. That's going to go away at the end of 2012, and that was only meant to be temporary in the first place. That was extended for 1 year in 2011 by the 2010 Act and then extended again in 2012, I believe, for one additional year. It's also what the fiscal cliff represents is the beginning of the tax increases associated with Obamacare, with its additional 0.9% Medicare tax on high-income earners or the 3.8% tax on passive income for high-income earners. That's going to be effective 01/01/2013 as well. And then finally, to repeat the earlier point, it represents the automatic deep spending cuts at the governmental level. I think it's been estimated the upside is that it's going to trim the deficit by about $560 billion. The downside is it's going to take about $500 billion out of the economy. And in addition to the decrease in GDP of 4 percentage points, the estimate is also that it will increase the unemployment rate by a full point as well.
It's a very complex issue, and I want to bring on our two other panelists so they can kind of illuminate some of the other aspects here. John Ellard with Vericor is with us. John's specialty is providing leadership to families and businesses in the area of wealth design and protection. John, welcome. And James McCartan is also here. Jim is a partner with Burr and Foreman, the firm's tax, trusts, and estates and corporate practice groups. Guys, welcome. I know
you've got
a lot to say about this issue as well. John, let's start with you. What are some of the things you're talking to clients around life insurance planning in today's economic uncertain environment?
Thanks for having us today. I think one of the things that we experience is having to deal with the uncertainty is short-term thinking. A series of short-term decisions sometimes makes for a poor plan. And when we're trying to do multi-generational business or estate planning, it does not lend to being able to make a fully developed plan or decision. So I think our clients oftentimes desire some certainty, and they think about life insurance as a way to accomplish some level of certainty in part of their plan. Life insurance isn't right for everyone, of course, but when they see it as a known benefit at an unknown time, it seems to make sense. Unfortunately, the law has been gyrating up and down regarding the estate and gift tax world. That clients sometimes, unless they're in the perfect sweet spot to do some significant planning, they just hold off. They just hold off and they just defer decisions. So we have some clients that think through making significant gifts, think through making some significant estate planning decisions, and then they just decide to wait because they think, well, I'll get one more bite at the apple later. Then we have some who see this as the worst case scenario. For example, the estate tax is scheduled to go from 35% to 55%. The scary number is today a couple can leave $10.24 million to their heirs without estate tax. Above that, it's 35% tax. That changes January 1 to a couple can leave $2 million. Above that, it's a 55% tax. So it's a shocking difference. Some people take the position that the worst case is going to happen and we're going to go back to that level, and they are making decisions to do things almost out of fear. Hopefully that doesn't happen, but that's the kind of environment that we're left with. I think Jim would agree that it's hard to make long-term plans for people that, again, are multi-generational when we have a tax policy that changes every 12 or 18 months.
When I started public accounting before law school was way, way back in the dark ages of the 70s. And at that time, we weren't seeing tax changes every 2 years. As we've progressed, it seems that every year now there is a very substantial tax bill that changes how we are taxing either an industry or a group of taxpayers. And so for me, I'm on the other side of Jason. I don't tend to represent the private equity folks. I represent the family businesses, those small, closely held businesses who are being acquired by the private equity groups. And they are truly faced with what do I want to accomplish long term and how do I get there? And then when you start layering in tax changes that can swing 20, 30, and even 40% at some times, that makes it very hard to really plan what your movement forward is going to be. I think it's important for us to help your audience remember that estate taxes and income taxes are two different types of taxes, okay? An income tax is based upon the annual amount of income that a taxpayer generates during the year. And it can come from investments, it can come from a business, it can come from lots of different sources, but it's a finite measurement. The estate and the gift tax is really a transfer tax. It's not a tax that's based on your income. It's a tax that's based on what you're giving away or how much you're giving away. But you really do have to try to meld your policies, your going forward plan for both of those if you are a closely held business. You know, if you have, if you are a business owner, have developed a really nice business, you haven't really been able to take too much income out of it, and let's just say the business is worth $10 million, well, right now, if you die today, your family's going to reap most of the value of that $10 million. If we fall off the fiscal cliff and you get hit by that proverbial truck in January, roughly $4 to $5 million of that net worth is going to have to be paid over to Uncle Sam merely because you died on the wrong day. And so a lot of what we're looking to do for our clients is help them anticipate what they can do to minimize the amount of taxes, and then look at other liquidity options, insurance, for example, and other ways to help them move forward. You know, one of the things that I'm seeing quite a bit of, again, and Jason alluded to this, is there's an awful lot of activity in the deal markets. There are an awful lot of companies who are acquiring or looking to acquire closely held businesses. And vice versa, there are a lot of closely held businesses who have decided, you know, my kids really don't have an interest in this. You know, they've gone to med school, they've gone to law school, they don't want to come back and run, you know, this manufacturing facility. So I'm going to have to sell. And the timing of that can be huge. You know, do you use the 15% capital gain rate now versus potentially a 23.8% capital gain rate as of January? Qualified dividends. You know, if you have a very large company and can move money now, do you do it at a 15% rate? Or after January, you know, do you do it at a what can be close to a 45% tax rate? So what I'm seeing with a lot of my clients is really an urgency for locking in as best they can the favorable tax rates, but delaying the financial impact of whatever transaction they are doing. So flexibility is key in almost everything we're doing right now.
And there are a lot of impacts that have been mentioned. I just want to reiterate some of the statistics from the Tax Policy Center newest report from the Urban Institute and Brookings Institution. As Jason mentioned, an average of almost $3,500 per household, and almost 90% of Americans would see their taxes rise. Jim, as you mentioned, taken together, these impacts really have an impact on behavior, and planned behavior and current behavior. The scheduled changes significantly increase the marginal tax rates, which do influence behavior, and average tax rates are planned to increase 5 percentage points on labor income, 7 points on capital gains, and by more than 20% on dividends. In addition, the estate tax would hit more than 10 times as many estates as in 2012. So, Susan, as you're talking to clients, what are you hearing them most concerned with regarding impending higher tax rates?
I guess from my firm's perspective, what we're hearing the most about is are the things that I'm hearing out there about getting out of the market, should I be listening to that? And we're, of course, saying no. You keep the course. Should I sell certain capital gains assets before the year end because of the increase? Well, you have to be very cautious about that, because also one of the tax changes that we're having to wait on is the patch for the AMT tax. And if you were to sell something to avoid the capital gains tax, the gain on that would not be taxed by the AMT, but it goes into the calculation of whether you're going to pay AMT. So there's just so many variables. It's really time to, as I stated before, that you must sit down on an individual basis and look at your situation and see, combined with what your goals are and your overall plan for retirement and whatever other goals you have for transferring it to family, all of that has to be taken into account as far as where you're going to go with this. A lot of times we say you don't want to let the tax tail wag the dog. In this particular year, that's can't just be said blatantly anymore, because the tax is probably more important than it's ever been before. So we are just trying to let clients know that this too shall pass, and we're going to get through this. And it's just very important that all the disciplines are looked at and looked at from a holistic point of view before any of those decisions are made.
Now, you're publicly vocal about CPAs becoming financial planners so that they can serve their clients in both capacities. Can you tell me a little bit more about this?
Well, sure. I as I stated, am a CPA, and I truly believe that CPAs are clients' most trusted advisor. They usually know most of what is going on in their financial life if they have a good relationship with their CPA. And CPAs can be financial planners. There is a financial planning credential that they can receive, and I am advocating for CPAs to become more involved in financial planning, because a lot of times financial planning is just used as a sales tool rather than a objective, independent tool and service that can be offered to clients.
And that's an important distinction. And your firm doesn't manage assets or sell products. So how do you work with clients on their investments?
We don't manage, as you stated, assets, but we do investment planning. So what we do is we educate the client on asset allocation and teach them that 91% of their return is actually from asset allocation and diversification. And we educate them on how to find the appropriate financial advisor, the investment advisor for them, make those introductions, and sit down with their investment advisor and explain, this is the asset allocation we'd like to use. Bring back your selection of securities, a portfolio for this client. Here is their investment policy statement that we've put together with them. And so that is all kept very independent and objective. There's no bias. There's no skin in the game, if you will, putting that asset allocation together. And then we hold their investment advisor accountable to stay in that allocation and to be disciplined to rebalance each year.
One of the things that I think is really important when you're working with clients, whether it's a family that has a family business, whether it's the clients who have retired, they've got the house down on the beach, you know, and a really big portfolio. What I think has changed over the years is that our clients are now so much more responsible for their own success through investing. You know, when my father retired, he retired from the government, from the military, and then had a private retirement. But that was set up as a pension plan. So he got whatever he got that the company told him he got. Well, these days, companies are much more using the 401k, the you put in, you invest, and when you retire, all of that gets rolled over, and so now you've got what I view as a business. You know, and so my view always has been, no matter who the client is, whether it's young, middle age, you know, older, retirement age, they ought to be thinking about their net worth as a business. And it really is for most of us. And what is your long-term plan? Because if you don't plan, I don't care what it is, if it's a business, if it's just investing, if you don't plan it and you don't ask the questions, you sort of reap what you sow, in that if you haven't put the time in, you are likely to fail in where you want to eventually be.
And as we're hearing this theme of coordinating with all of your advisors and letting each of them advise on their particular domain. And there are a lot of aspects to these changes and still a lot of uncertainty about what exactly is going to change and when. Jason, I wonder if you could walk us through some more on the alternative minimum tax and what is scheduled to expire, the patch on the AMT, is that how?
Yeah, the AMT is really the alternative minimum tax, and it's been around from an individual perspective for probably about 40 years. I think it was legislated into existence in 1969. It was originally intended to be a tax that was calculated in conjunction with the regular tax, and you pay the higher of the two liabilities. And again, it was intended to capture typically very high-income, high-net-worth individuals. Over time, it was never adjusted for inflation. And so what's happened as incomes have risen for the middle class, the AMT has expanded to capture a lot of those middle-income, middle-class taxpayers and subject them to AMT. Furthermore, AMT was really designed as a prepayment system. But as it relates to what typically trips middle-income taxpayers into AMT, that creates more of a permanent tax impact or permanent tax increase. And what's referred to as the patch is really just the adjusting the exemption for inflation. And when properly done, that patch excludes many or most of the taxpayers that were never intended to be captured up in the alternative minimum tax calculation. And the problem is it's such a big revenue raiser now for the Treasury that it's just difficult to deal with. They address it in 1 or 2 year patches. I believe the most current patch has already expired as of 12/31/2011. And that's part of the uncertainty that everyone is talking about. You know, people in this room or people listening to this broadcast could be subject to AMT as we speak and not know it, depending upon whether the patch gets pushed through sometime in 2013. And that's a very frustrating position for taxpayers to be put in.
I know people want to make sure that they have all the appropriate information, especially with the election coming up, and you hear about a lot of these things and you might not have all the information. Another term we hear about all the time is the Bush tax cuts. Talk specifically, will you, my panel, about the Bush tax cuts and what may or may not happen with them.
You know, the Bush tax cuts really encompasses two different tax relief acts. They're commonly referred to as, you know, in short, ECTRA and JECTRA, back to 2001 and 2003. And 2003 primarily worked to accelerate a lot of the 2001 provisions, then introduced a couple of other new provisions. I believe that qualified dividends came online in 2003. But really what the Bush tax cuts were are a lessening or decreasing of the capital gains tax rates to the current 15% and a lowering of the overall tax brackets. Prior to 2001, the highest tax bracket was 39.6%. Currently, the highest tax bracket is at 35%. But those are the ones that should have expired because of the way they passed it. They had to pass it through the resolution process and only needed a majority versus a supermajority, I believe. But as a result, they have to expire. And the original expiration date was slated to be December 31st, 2010. But the 2010 Taxpayer Relief Act extended those for another 2 years. And now there is discussion about what to do with them as they come up for expiration, whether you extend them again across the board or whether you extend them piecemeal or only for certain taxpayers. There's been some discussion about not extending them for taxpayers that have adjusted gross income, married filing joint basis of in excess of $250,000, but extending them across the board for everyone below that threshold.
One of the things I think is important in this discussion is that over the last 10 to 15 years, and this is one of those technical sort of gotchas that I think that our Congress really does not appreciate, and maybe even the IRS does not appreciate quite as much. we have moved away from using the corporate structure for many of our new businesses. And the reason that we move away from a corporation, a C-Corp, is that the income is then taxed directly on the owner's tax return. And what happens is that we are seeing a large number of small, closely held businesses, and I'm one of the lawyers that I do this almost as a knee-jerk reaction for my clients, is that if it's a small business and it's startup, we're usually going to do it in a pass-through structure. Well, that means that if there is a net profit of $250,000 on that business, it's showing up on the personal tax return of the owner. Well, that $250,000 may be the net profit for the business, but it is certainly not the net profit that owner can put in his or her pocket and spend any way, shape, or form they wish to. They've got to put working capital back in. They've got to look at new hiring. They've got to look at capital expenditures. You know, do I buy a new car? Do I buy additional inventory? And so you have those decisions, but the net's showing up on the personal return. So this arbitrary $250,000 number, at least for me, is a real problem, because many of my clients are successful business people. And yeah, they've got net incomes of $250,000 or $300,000 or $400,000, which sounds like a really big number. But that's not the actual number that they're able to take out of the business. And as a result, every time we start talking about these arbitrary numbers for when somebody is wealthy and when they ought to pay more tax, we're not really focused on the impact of that tax with regard to businesses. And it's businesses that create, small business that creates the most jobs. So if we don't start making those distinctions at a policy level, I'm afraid we are continuing to push toward not having the fullest recovery possible. Now, I'm not an economist. That's not what I study. But I can tell you, when my client pays an extra $5,000 of tax, that's $5,000 that they're not getting to use in their business.
So what is the ramification then for the overall economy when you start to create those arbitrary numbers and legislate accordingly?
Well, I mean, from my view, and I'm very simplistic about it, I think you make a mistake and you hurt the economy.
Yeah, I think it creates muffled growth, because people have a wait and see attitude. They keep their money in the bank. They keep their money on the sidelines. They opt not to expand their business until additional certainty is provided. And I agree with Jim's earlier point. I think there's a tremendous disconnect between the average taxpayer who gets a W-2 and in their mind equates taxable income to cash in hand. But when you talk about income from a pass-through entity, taxable income in no way, shape, form, or fashion equates to cash in hand. You know, it could be sitting in your accounts receivable at the business and not represent cash at all, or you could take that money and invest some or all of it back into property, plant, and equipment for the business. But I think that, you know, and I'm not sure if you're into that through an education process with the politicians or if they know and don't care, but I certainly think that that disconnect exists currently.
Now, John, how are life insurance solutions affected by a rising tax rate environment?
Two ways, really. From an estate tax standpoint, people planning their estates will look at life insurance solutions more favorably. So because life insurance products, the death benefit that's paid, is not subject to income tax. So I think life insurance products will become could become more of a focus. People with cash value life insurance experience tax deferred growth on the cash value. So in a rising income tax rate environment, life insurance products that build cash value will also look more favorable. So I think you'll see some benefits there. People also own annuity products, there's a great debate out there in the world about whether that's a good investment. We're not in the investment side of the world. We're just in the life insurance side of the world. But annuity products where people invest and are not taxed on the growth inside of an annuity would also benefit from that rising tax rate environment.
Now, Jason, some of the effects that we're talking about are also business-related. The deductibility of state and local taxes and the business provisions include research and experimentation credit, the work opportunity tax credit, many other targeted incentives. How do these play into the equation?
A lot of what you're talking about are under the so-called extender provisions, to where they're addressed on a year-in, year-out basis by Congress, and either extended or not extended. And, you know, those might include bonus depreciation. Really, I guess the AMT patch now is part of that. The R&D credit, to your earlier point, the work opportunity tax credit. And again, it just adds to this environment of uncertainty. I mean, the fact, again, that people here, people listening to this broadcast, could be paying alternative minimum tax right now and not know it, I think is, borders on the ridiculous. And also, when Congress creates these credits or these incentives, entire cottage industries spring up around these incentives to service them. There are companies out there that deal only with claiming the R&D credit or only in claiming the work opportunity tax credit. And some of those are very time sensitive around how you have to address them. And so they either have to shut the doors when extenders are not immediately available and there's uncertainty around them, or they have to continue to move forward, continue to pay employees, live off lines of credit, and hope that at some point in time those provisions are extended in a retroactive manner that then allows them to go back and basically monetize the work that they've been doing throughout the tax year.
Now, we've mentioned the gift tax as well, and that's a substantial change. Federal and state gift tax revert to pre-2001 levels. That will reduce the amount that can be transferred to heirs from more than $10 million to only $2 million. Jim, when you're talking about making business planning decisions, personal planning decisions, charitable giving decisions, how does this play into the conversation?
Well, the gift and the estate tax are tied together. And so what happens is that every individual has what they call an exemption amount, and that's where the $5 million, $1 million sort of comes in. And if you use it during your lifetime, then anything else you've got at death is subject to the estate tax. So if you exceed the exemption, you then pay gift tax. And so we really look at working with our clients to ensure that the least amount of transferred taxes are paid. And there are lots of different structures that are available, depending upon the types of assets held by the individual. And again, for me, most of what I work with are the business entities and their families. And so a lot of what we are looking at currently is how do you use the $5 million exclusion currently without necessarily cutting off access to everything that you might need in the future. If a client is 60 years old and they've got a life expectancy of another 25 years and they've got a $5 million estate, it's one thing to take that $5 million, put it in a trust for the kids and the grandkids, and basically wall it off from the client. Most clients don't like me a lot if they can't use the net worth that they've spent their lifetime building. And so it's really important that we look at the types of assets that are available, how we move things around. It includes cash flows, because cash flows are important in funding retirement and moving appreciation to the next generation. And there are just many, many different opportunities to do that. One of the things I'd like to just mention on John's behalf is this new 3.8% tax with regard to what is being called passive income. Like the income tax, life insurance is also exempt from that additional tax. And so one of the things that I am seeing much more of is that insurance and cash value insurance really is becoming more of an investment decision than necessarily just a traditional estate and gift planning opportunity. You know, doctor and lawyer are young professionals. They have three kids. You know, they have a portfolio of $500,000. They're going to be taxed with this extra amount. They may decide now's the time to look at life insurance. We needed it anyway. And they're taking part of their portfolio and moving it into insurance, mostly to avoid all that extra tax, because, you know, the rule is if you can defer a tax a year, you've deferred that tax. So one of the other things that we try to do is make sure that we push the taxes off as long as possible, understanding that eventually they do often have to be paid.
Right. They catch up with you at some point.
Right. And that's a discussion we try to have with people about balancing tax cost versus insurance cost. Because if you do what Jim just suggested, is you place a lot of your capital in a life insurance policy, you're subject to policy charges. So you have to be careful to make sure that the policy charges don't outweigh the tax benefit. So it's not always a black and white situation. Well, you know, one of the things I keep hearing is lots of different angles and approaches on a client situation, and you have to have collaboration. Absolutely. Dealing with you brought up this conversation about gifting, and I think everybody would agree that anyone thinking of maximizing the gift opportunity for this year has to be very careful. You really need to go through an exercise of what is your personal capital need for your lifetime. You're a 60-year-old person with a 25-year-old life expectancy. What do they need for their life, health, welfare, maintenance? And then what do they want to go to their children? There's two distinct conversations. You don't want to gift in advance of making sure that the first generation is taken care of carefully. And then you have to look at the estate tax and determine, you know, some people call that social capital, whether you're going to pay taxes to the government or you're going to choose your charity. And so this is a very, I think, an interactive conversation from all aspects, whether it's, you know, traditional investments, paper investments, businesses, taxes, insurance products, legal aspects, legal tools and techniques. You have to have everyone at the table.
One of the interesting byproducts of all this uncertainty is that it really affects so many more small businesses and what I would traditionally view as the middle, you know, the middle income, middle wealthy, if you will, taxpayers. You know, if somebody has grown a business and he and his wife have invested in some real estate, you know, they built a lake house, they, you know, have the home, they upgraded the home, and so between the retirement plan and the business and the real estate, they've got a $15 million estate. That's a lot more difficult to plan than a $50 million estate, because the $50 million estate, you can almost take that $10 million off the top, put it where it, you know, is going to be, it's going to be protected from the estate tax, and then you're dealing with how are we going to afford to pay. Whereas when the $15 million couple, It's how are they going to continue to survive? How do we make sure all of those income streams that they need are still around and yet not have a situation where when both mom and dad are dead, we're looking at a $15 million, that's going to be $6.5 to $7 million of estate tax, and how are they going to pay it? So it's really a much more difficult plan.
Now, given the current economic environment, what should clients of insurance policies, financial plannings, what should the conversation that they're having with their advisors be about right now? And how frequently should clients be checking in with their advisors or having these conversations at this point in time?
Well, I'll jump in just because I think it's easier from the lawyer standpoint is that, you know, your investment advisor and your CPA is often the gatekeeper. You know, the CPA knows your return inside and out. You know, the lawyers tend to do the big picture planning and not really run the detail numbers. I can do that if I have to. But because I left public accounting 25 years ago, I always tell my clients if they make me do accounting, it's double my hourly rate. So, you know, I just don't enjoy it. You know, but that's why having this kind of group of advisors is so important for every client that's out there. You know, everybody brings a certain expertise to the table, and it's just like any other advice. You need to weigh all of the aspects and make your own decision. But my view is the lawyer is oftentimes the least important because the CPA or the CFP is going to know we got to go get the lawyer to do the big planning. So I'm thinking that between now and the end of the year, you know, most of your audience ought to be thinking, when was the last time I talked to my CFP? When was the last time I talked to my CPA? When was the last time I talked to my insurance guy? And what's going to happen if the fiscal cliff occurs next year? What's my worst case scenario? And what do I do to mitigate that? Because you may not want to just take a leap of faith that it's going to happen, because the downside of getting out of a lot of your investments, a lot of your other structures can be that if they do extend, some of these rates do extend the value of the estate tax exemption, that you will spend a lot of money on a lawyer that you didn't need to.
Right. I mean, with this kind of uncertainty, it's difficult to know what are the right investments, both for the accumulation phase as well as for the distribution phase of managing your overall wealth portfolio. One of the changes could be a 20% increase on rates of dividend income, which is a staple for many retired taxpayers. Does that change the way that you look at investable assets, Susan?
Well, for right now, we're making sure that especially our retirees have an 18-month cash reserve so that pulling these dividends out is not going to affect them quite as much right now. It used to be 6 months was sufficient, but now with the way that the markets are and with all the uncertainty, we're really advising people to make sure they have 18 months in their investment accounts in cash reserves. And one thing I wanted to just go back to your previous question, because it's so important. We have so many clients come to us, and we don't prepare taxes, so I feel it's okay to say this. So many come to us that do their own taxes. They think that, and TurboTax is great, and other things out there are great, but they think that that is sufficient. And I would really like to strongly suggest, if you do not have a CPA who prepares your taxes, that this is the year you need to be willing to go get a CPA to do your taxes.
Or at least check your return and look at it and consult with you about what your plan is.
Yes, absolutely. And because for the potential for the estate tax to go down to $1 million, that can affect so many more people if you haven't thought about doing estate planning, you think you're okay, you don't have an estate planning attorney, and there's so many people that do their wills online or have their corporate attorney or their real estate attorney do their wills. If that is any of the listeners out there, I would just really strongly admonish you to go to an estate planning attorney. This is just a real time in our history that this is just very important. It's no longer that we can all be jacks of all trades and do these things ourselves. We really need people who specialize in these areas to take a look at these for us.
Susan, I want to ask you a question because it sort of hits me personally. You know, I've always lived by that six-month rule, six-month of cash. You know, I can see the move to 18 months with the retirees. What about somebody like me? I mean, are you all at the point where you're suggesting greater cash reserves for even those of us who are still employed and not retired?
Well, the general rule for an emergency reserve for a married couple where both work is 3 months. But for a single person or a married couple where only one is a wage earner, that would be for 6 months. It is not going to hurt to add a couple of months onto that. That's very, very important in the economy today. And just with the payroll tax increase that is going to supposedly happen, unless there's some great intervention, that alone, just that one piece, is expected to reduce earners' incomes by $1,000 next year. So for people that are living paycheck to paycheck, which is a lot of people out there, they need to make sure that they find $100 a month that they don't spend anymore, because they are going to receive approximately that much less in each one of their paychecks. So there, it's really a time to go through your spending plan. And we like the word spending plan better than budget. It just feels better because you are spending this money. So it's really an important time to go through that spending plan and be able to look and objectively make decisions as a family as to what you can remove.
So I need to be talking with my wife about the additions that we're giving our adult daughters with their spending plans.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Good
Thank
luck
you.
With that.
That's helpful.
Comprehensive family planning discussion here. Now, John, what about clients with life insurance policies? What do they need to know about how the current economic environment is affecting their policy?
Yeah,
existing policies.
Okay, I want to take a minute and to answer two questions at once. You ask about how often clients should sit down with advisors, and Jim said that sometimes, you know, he's the last person to the table because CFP and CPA are so active every year. And I'd give clients advice about this. If they do not have an intentional collaborative process between their CFP, investment person, and their CPA, they need to go hire that at a minimum, because that's where you're going to get short-term view and have the opportunity for long-term thinking. So if they don't have something that's intentional review every year, then they need to go find it. Circling back to life insurance, you know, the economic environment that we're in, especially the low interest rate environment, is having a significant impact on life insurance policies. And so we would tell people to do an annual review of your policy, literally an annual review. A lot of times people buy an insurance policy and they kind of tuck it away in a drawer and they don't touch it for years and years. That's not a good plan. You know, we take a very proactive approach on policy management. It's no, an insurance policy is no different than a financial plan in some respects. You have to design it, you have to implement it, and you have to manage it. Low interest rates are creating surprises that people don't like having to pay more premium than anticipated. We reviewed a client's policy that went up 400% in premium to maintain the policy to the client's life expectancy. So that was a big surprise. And that is all driven off of the interest rate assumption that's within the policy. They bought it about 15 years ago, and the crediting rate inside the policy was 6.6%. Now the crediting rate inside the policy is 3.8%. therefore they're having, I would call that a premium surprise, premium call.
Ouch.
So
that's
a problem.
Yes. And that's why it's so important to be having these regular conversations with your advisors, because there are estate and income tax and financial planning opportunities that are available prior to the year end, after the year end, continuously as you have this ongoing dialogue. So we've got a tradition here on the show. Since it's the Results Matter show, we like to talk about the results that do matter. And we've touched on some of these already. I want to give each of the opportunity to chime in on what's most important from your perspective, and also the uncertainty in the government environment right now and what results really matter there in terms of creating a stable environment that is going to facilitate and allow for proactive estate planning going forward. So Susan, let's start with you on results that matter to your clients.
Well, I think one of the most important things that could happen from a policy perspective is really making sure that there are positive and favorable corporate tax policies for businesses. The majority of our clients are small businesses as well, and everything, as has already been stated this morning, is on hold. So I think when the election is over and hopefully Congress is more willing to play together, that they can come up with a very good corporate policy, because there's just been so much inaction, inactivity, and waiting, because company, large and small, are all waiting for this to happen. I think that would be a result that would really make a difference.
Absolutely. Jason, why don't you dive in here as well? You've mentioned the impact of the uncertainty on the economy and some of your clients and the ramifications. Talk about what results matter to them.
I think certainty in the U.S. has always been really a competitive advantage for us. And I think what's lost to politicians is that the uncertainty that exists now erodes that competitive advantage that we have traditionally enjoyed on the international stage. And there are certain elements of uncertainty that just, you know, that can't be controlled, whether it's the Middle East or the EU debt crisis. There's nothing that can be done about that right now, but this is uncertainty that, to Jim's earlier point, not only did they create, but they also have the power to immediately address and mitigate. And at a minimum, whether the outcome is favorable or unfavorable, they owe it to the American taxpayer to let them know what the rules are and then let the taxpayers play the game. But until you let the taxpayers know what the rules are, then it's just going to be this sideline approach to where everyone's in this wait-and-see mode.
And I think I have to ditto that. I heard a speech in 2009, remember those terrible days, and a business leader said back then, if the government will create the rules, tell the business leaders what the rules are, business will figure out a way to respond. And so we've been in the kind of same up and down environment, short-term thinking, short-term decision-making, and business can't respond. So I think the most important thing is sustainability. Make a decision that can be sustained. And we know there's always tension around the fiscal issues of taxes and spending. There's always going to be tension around that. But try to make a decision that can stick.
Jim?
My view, because I agree with all of what was said earlier, I want to go back to one point, and that is that no matter what your personal situation is, whether you're a business owner, whether you're a retiree, is that you really need to take responsibility for your family's business plan. And that's the way that I tend to talk with my clients about it. It's a family business plan. And whether that's the two clients who are professors at a major university who take the position that, you know, their parents didn't leave them anything, so whatever their kids get is more than they thought, and anything over the exemptions going to charity. At least talk about all that. Let's figure out what the plan is so that you can actually implement it rather than having things occur just by happenstance.
Absolutely. It's just too important. Well, thank you once again to my excellent panel. This is Elizabeth Gordon, and you've been listening to Results Matter. Jim McCartan, partner of Burr and Foreman. Jason Meadows, tax partner at Fraser & Dieter. Susan Tillery, president co-founder of Paraclete Financial. And John Ellard at Vericor. We will talk to you next week.
This has been a joint production of Burr and Foreman and Business Radio X. Burr and Foreman is a full-service law firm with offices across the Southeast. If results matter to you and you want them to matter to your law firm, please give Burr and Foreman a call at 404-685-4337. For more information and to find the right attorney for you, visit burr.com. That's B-U-R-R.com.